Hello, everybody, and welcome to an extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about an American Tale. I am one of your hosts, the French statue pervert, Bob Mackie, and who is here with me today, as always?
Paving my roads with cheese, Henry Gilbert.
And yes, on this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, we are digging into Steven Spielberg's first real dabbling with animation. And of course, that is via the Don Bluth movie, An American Tale. It is an immigrant story. It's Don Bluth making his first real success outside of the Walt Disney Company, one that would pave the way for at least 13 more years worth of movies to come.
Yeah, it's we're deep in our childhoods here with this one, when Steven Spielberg could pretty much make anything. And this is in the context of us doing Who Framed Roger Rabbit and other ones. It was really cool to go back to his first animated film that's before producing Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
And on this podcast, you're going to hear a little preview of the history segment. But if you want to hear the entire history segment and the movie segment where we talk about the movie in depth, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. And when you do, you'll unlock the rest of this podcast and over 6 years worth of other What a Cartoon Movie podcasts. They're all between 3 and 6 hours long for the most part. We've covered at this point the entire Disney Renaissance. If you like Don Bluth, we've also covered The Secret of Nim. We've covered anime movies like Ghost in the Shell and The Animatrix and Cowboy Bebop the Movie and Kiki's Delivery Service, a lot of anime movies. We've kind of covered every kind of animated movie, and if there's an animated movie you want us to cover, odds are we will probably cover it at some point in the future, and that is all happening at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons, and when you sign up for that, you get the $5 stuff as well. Henry, what is happening at the $5 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons?
You get so many things, starting with ad-free podcasts where you don't have to hear ads like this one on any of the ones we put out of Talking Simpsons or What a Cartoon either. Plus, each month you get a brand new episode of Talking Futurama and a new episode of Talk King of the Hill, where we go super in-depth into those shows just like we do The Simpsons or An American Tale. And you get the entire back catalog of that, too, which is us covering all the previous episodes of Futurama and King of the Hill and every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and many of our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series. We go into super in-depth history on all of those, and that's included in the $5 level, which you also get access to when you sign up for the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons to hear the rest of this movie podcast.
And if you've never signed up for Patreon before, it's so easy to do. And once you sign up, you can use any podcast app or device you might have to listen to all of our bonus podcasts the same way you listen to all of your free podcasts as part of your podcasting lifestyle. But that is it for our little sales pitch. Now sit back, salute Lady Liberty, and get ready to hear a chunk of our history about An American Tale. Before I go on any further, let's talk about a little guy named Don Bluth. And because it's been 6 years, I can give everybody out there a little recap of how Don Bluth Productions began. And it's all thanks to the research I did for Secret of Nim 6 years ago. Yes, my old notes are full of useful tidbits, just like all the books behind Lionel Hutz. I love referring to my old notes. I've built up quite a library by now. So instead of just like jamming the audio file into this podcast, I can just go over what happened to Bluth in a very truncated way. So, tiny recap on Bluth. He was actually hired by Disney in 1955, worked there for 2 years before leaving for his mandatory Mormon church mission to Argentina, and apparently he worked on Sleeping Beauty while he was there. After he gets back from Argentina, he works on and off for Disney, mostly uncredited, and then, shockingly, Filmation. So, at a very early age, he's working for Disney. His church life interrupts that, and then he's splitting time between Disney and being a full-time guy at Filmation. And, you know, not a great time for the animation industry when he is returning to it post-Argentina.
Yeah, that's he gets in there as, like, Walt is near death, I would guess, if Sleeping Beauty. Like, his not many years left for old Walt. And then Bluth shows up thinking he's going to get to make, you know, all the next movies with Walt. And I would guess he probably looked up to him to the same level he looked up to John Smith in
Brigham Young.
Brigham Young, yeah.
Yes, big Mormon. So finally, Don Bluth begins working at Disney full time in 1971. Suffers through a horrible decade for the company in terms of feature animation because there are only 4 features, and one of them is a bunch of stitched together Winnie the Pooh shorts. So they're not doing great in the 70s. But then during the production of The Fox and the Hound, Bluth does something that will change his life forever. So, on September 13th, 1979, Don Bluth, on his 42nd birthday, assembles with Gary Goldman and John Pomeroy. They walk into the Disney CEO's office, Ron Miller, and they resign. And then 13 other animators resign from The Fox and the Hound with them. So they storm out of there. They hand in their resignations. And then they go off to do their own stuff. And we talk a little bit more about that in the NIMH podcast. And the reason why Bluth left is because he thought Disney was losing their way. And he wanted to make movies in the grand tradition of classic Disney films, the ones that were out when he was a youth. And it's funny that that's what he wanted to do, because much of the problem with The Fox and the Hound was a battle of the older, old men wanting to run things versus the younger generation who were real spitfires and wanted to do things their own way. So I really think Bluth was falling in line with the old timers when it came to working on The Fox and the Hound. It was like, who's this Tim Burton kid? Get him out of here.
I could see how Bluth thought, like, he's like, why am I not in charge of this entire thing? Like, I'm the guy who should be running this. Meanwhile, as we talked in the Black Cauldron too, in when you cover that history, like, there's question of if they're going to keep it even going, the Disney feature animation. Do they need to make any new ones, or can they just make the money re-releasing a 5-year cycle of Pinocchio and Snow White and the rest over and over and make their yearly money that way?
Yeah, that was the question Michael Eisner asked. Why are we making new features? Because a re-release of, let's say, Snow White will make more than a new movie that we have to sink production costs into. So what are we even doing here? Why can't we just live off of our legacy? So, Bluth leaves and then forms Don Bluth Productions. And his first projects were short subjects. So there was an animated sequence for the movie Xanadu. And there was also the short film Banjo the Woodpile Cat. And they're both very Bluthy productions. And apparently they were working on Banjo the Woodpile Cat on the side while still employed at Disney. And they hoped that Ron Miller would look at the short and fund it, but he refused to even see it. So that's really what convinced them to leave. They were like, we're working on this short on our own time. We really think it would be great if you could fund the rest. We could release it through Disney. And he was like, no, get it away from me. Stop moonlighting. You work for me.
I wonder how much creating their own competition in Bluth was held against Ron Miller, or if even the bosses then even cared during the upheaval. But I mean, I remember seeing when I did the Brad Bird research for the Iron Giant, because he was there too. And also from the Waking Sleeping Beauty, which is the official Disney story of this time too. Those seem to characterize that, like, Don Bluth had his guys, and if you were on the outside of that group, you didn't get invited to leave with him.
Yeah.
So it seemed like it was a real, like, in-group and out-group deal there, too.
And his guys were working on Banjo the Woodpile Cat with him in his home and garage before there was a proper studio. They moved to a studio to work on the piece for Xanadu, but Woodpile Cat was largely produced, like, within his property by people just coming over and doing it on their own time. And the people that were under him on this, they believed in his mission of let's return to the classic Disney style. And Bluth thought it was over by Lady and the Tramp. He felt like that was the last time the Disney magic was still in the features.
Now, that makes it, man. Now, to hear that he was basically our age when he went off on his own, that's a shocker now to imagine that.
It's never too late for a second chapter, everybody. Look at Don Bluth. He really turned things around. So, yes, again, check out our NIMH podcast to learn more about the connective tissue between that movie and this one. Because after the Xanadu piece, after Banjo, then NIMH comes along, and then it's An American Tale. So, before we talk about the history, I have to say that An American Tale has been completely devalued. So you can find some retrospectives online, but there's no real definitive oral history, or there's no definitive making of. And the home media releases, I think until recently, kind of butchered the film while adding no extras. So there is really not a whole lot to go on here. I downloaded what was apparently a Blu-ray rip, and it looks very nice. And I'm sure it was like a bare bones release. But I believe the first DVD release of Fievel of An American Tale cut stuff, and it's in full screen and it adds sound effects. It's a very weird adulteration of that movie that pissed a lot of people off. And then later you could buy it like in a 3-pack or a 4-pack with the sequels. It was never treated like this was a big deal. This is the first movie Steven Spielberg produced that was animated. It was not given the prestige that it had back in 86.
It's really nuts because it was such a huge hit and it's something you can build on. But, you know, with the history of like Amblimation and the DreamWorks later, like I can see why by the DVD era, Universal seemingly doesn't give as much of a shit about working on this stuff when they have lost all of these people to DreamWorks by like, you know, 99. Plus, by the DVD era, the 2D films aren't doing as hot as compared to CGI. And here's this ancient thing about our mouse. They probably are like, well, it's not 1986 anymore. We're not selling ALF DVDs that much either, guys. So why bother?
So yeah, nobody really remembers this movie, although I will say it is very important. So luckily, there is a 2022 Bluth autobiography called Somewhere Out There, My Animated Life. Unfortunately, I could not access the entire autobiography before recording this podcast, but I was at least able to access the piece about the making of An American Tale. Vulture published that excerpt alone. So thanks to Vulture for publishing that, because it includes like basically my entire history of the film and the production.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, that NIMH thing you mentioned on that, since we covered that one, I had sent you some clips from it too, but that I had read a 2003 long, basically book length interview with Bruce Timm about his career. And there's a part in Bruce Timm's early days working on NIMH, and his regard of Don Bluth was that he was like, that he was almost like a cult, like, or a preacher. He would like, he said he like literally would like preach, not surprising that he was trained as a person who preaches scripture to people, that he would do the same except for the religion of animation. And it sounded like, you know, it was a drinking Kool-Aid type of scenario if you're working at Bluth.
Yeah, I guess he did leave Disney with his apostles.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I can also see that that could be kind of an intense place if you're not down with the Bluth doctrine.
So in order to beef up this history segment a little, I do want to talk about Steven Spielberg almost entirely because I'm really getting back into Spielberg again and seeing a lot of the older movies I haven't seen before, seeing some of the newer ones I haven't seen before. But if you need to be briefed on Spielberg, check out the Blank Check podcast series that's going on right now. It's really, really good. I love the work they're doing. Every episode is like 3 hours long, so you're getting exhaustive conversations about all of these older movies. So as for Steven Spielberg, absolute wunderkind, directs his first episode of television at the age of 23, and then goes on to invent the Hollywood blockbuster with Jaws before the age of 30. So if you want to feel bad about your accomplishments, look at Steven Spielberg, because he's out there, he's doing it, and when this movie comes out, he's not even 40. When An American Tale comes out, I think he's like 39.
Wow, man. No, it was, his career is amazing. It's easy to forget because he was just like breathing the air of the 80s. If you're a kid of the 80s, you probably watched religiously movies he directed on VHS. And if it wasn't one of those ones he directed, he was probably an executive producer of one of the great films of the 80s you loved as a kid. Right? Too many to name, honestly.
So between Jaws and An American Tale, he directs the biggest movies ever, and they're all so very different from each other. Things like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and The Color Purple. They're all just so different from each other, and they're all just breaking records, winning over critics, winning Oscars, and breaking box office records. So he's really on a roll, and we can forget he directed 1941. Let's put that behind us in the history of Steven Spielberg. And I must say, I did watch the whole thing. I think I mentioned this on 4 podcasts now. I've watched the entire director's cut of 1941. Don't do it, or do it as a second screen experience. Occasionally look up at the great miniature work or the great practical effects, and then look back down at your phone as like weird, racist, sexist jokes happen, and you don't want to really pay too close attention to them.
It's funny, in Empire of the Sun, there's American GIs in the film that feel like they're stuck in between the characters of 1941 and characters from an Indiana Jones film. Like, it's an interesting balance he has of like comic relief characters in this prisoner of war film.
Well, I will say 1941 did give us Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, and they were allowed to fail on a gigantic scale like 3 more times before they made Back to the Future. So there you have it. That, if anything, 1941 kind of gave us Back to the Future in a way.
And not to spoil what our next month's movie is too, but I've also been thinking, I was already doing research on that too. I'm thankful, Bob, you're giving Spielberg context I won't have to give as much of next month when we talk about that director.
So in 1980, Steven Spielberg forms Amblin Entertainment, named after Amblin, which was his 1968 short he essentially made as a calling card to get his foot in the door of Hollywood. That short is online on YouTube in a very bad rip. I wish he would make it available in a more official way, because we've been seeing Amblin in the Amblin logo for now over 40 years, and I feel like we need a little more context.
Yeah, why? I mean, is he just waiting for his death? Like, when he finally dies, he's like, fine, then you can open up the archives and put out this stuff.
Maybe it's like The Day the Clown Cried or something, but honestly, it's a 30-minute short. I heard it's very good. I'm going to watch it eventually, because, again, it is available, but I wish it was available in more than just a bad, bad transfer from some unknown source. So yes, we have Amblin, and it's a production company that truly makes Steven Spielberg a brand, because it is the stamping of Steven Spielberg Presents on a variety of movies, letting you know that the god of movies, the guy who makes the best popcorn entertainment, said this is something you should watch. Weirdly enough, the first Amblin movie is something called Continental Divide, which is a John Belushi vehicle absolutely no one remembers. Everyone was way behind John Belushi, and I wish he had more time to prove himself to me, Bob Mackie. But whenever I go back in time and watch John Belushi, I feel like, man, he is one note. I don't get it. I had my own fat guys. I'm sorry. I think Chris Farley had a lot more dimensionality, and I guess he died around the same age.
He was dead before we were born. And I mean, I was looking at his photos of his funeral were out there recently, and just seeing, you know, Dan Aykroyd as a pallbearer and walking and driving his motorcycle at the start of the procession. Like, you feel so much for them. It seriously, like, his Saturday Night Live debut is 1975. He's dead within 7 years of that. Like, that is insane.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, like, I do feel like, for us, our coked out fat guy, Chris Farley, he did get to show, even in Tommy Boy, he got to show a lot more like emotionality than he wasn't just hiding behind the character of Bluto or Blues Brother, whichever, in the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get it. I wasn't there. I wish he would have lived, obviously, but so much of 1941 is showing you John Belushi being a big fat pig, and that's why people showed up. They're like, all right, let's show me John Belushi, like, guzzling a big bottle of Coke. That'll be fun. Or, like, smashing food into his face. That's all it took. That's all it took.
I mean, they joked about it. Like, that was one of the, like, dark, painful things, but funny, on the Saturday Night Live 50, they show the John Belushi dancing on their graves. Like, it's called Don't Look Back in Anger. And the joke of it when they made it in, I believe, 79 was John Belushi actually outlives everybody. And it's just like, that's the joke, because they knew then he will be dead first.
Yeah. There were similar jokes about Chris Farley when he was on SNL. They could definitely see this coming. So yeah, we have Continental Divide. Nobody cares. But then the 80s gives us so many Amblin things that became touchstones for elder millennials and Gen Xers alike. Things like Gremlins and Poltergeist, Back to the Future, The Goonies, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and more. Weird stuff like Batteries Not Included. There are so many Amblin movies. But again, it's just seeing Steven Spielberg Presents, including later shows like Tiny Toon Adventures and Animaniacs and Freakazoid. So it was existing into the world of television as well.
And Spielberg did become a kingmaker of so many creatives. Like, again, from stuff we've covered before, you know, we mentioned that on the Roger Rabbit one, like, the only reason that happened is because Spielberg wanted it to happen, and they would do anything to please Steven Spielberg. Every studio would. And same with in the Iron Giant history of Brad Bird. In the 80s, Spielberg for a while thought he could do something big with Brad Bird, that would be an animation director he'd work with. It's why Brad Bird directs Family Dog for Amazing Stories, is because Spielberg was also looking at him as an animator, because he loves all movies, including cartoons.
And even though he directed the worst part of the Twilight Zone movie, and I guess the worst part would be the part that actually killed people, but in terms of a narrative, Kick the Can is the worst part of the Twilight Zone movie. He gave directors their first big chances, like Joe Dante and George Miller. The John Lithgow, Gremlin on the Wing kind of set piece there, that was George Miller's first American anything.
Yes.
Period.
Yeah, no, that Bob, we talked about that in our treehouse, how it keeps referencing it references the Lithgow one more than the Shatner one, honestly, because it's more visually interesting, like George Miller and Joe Dante's episode is pretty good too. It's pretty, and it's all about cartoons as well.
Yeah. All I say, if you want to watch that movie, just watch the Terror at Whatever Feet segment, and also the It's a Good Life segment. You can just tune everything else out.
Yeah, yeah. Especially you want to see Nancy Cartwright acting like that. Oh, God. She has such a funny story about how, like, just Joe Dante hired her because his on her resume said she worked with Dawes Butler, and he knew who that was and was like, oh, then you're hired. Like,
it's such an odd appearance by Nancy Cartwright. Whenever I see her in live action, I'm thinking, like, what happened? I shouldn't be able to see you. It should be just like a little boy or something.
She's been trapped in cartoons ever since.
Mm-hmm. Now let's return to Don Bluth. So he is not having the great time in the 80s that Steven Spielberg is having, because 1982's The Secret of Nim was completely destroyed at the box office by Steven Spielberg, because E.T. released that season. And Henry, we did an E.T. podcast for Retronauts with, I believe, Diamond Fight in a few years ago. And a lot of that podcast was just underlining the fact, like, you don't know how big E.T. was. At one point, E.T. was the highest grossing movie of all time. And it just kept getting re-released over and over and over again until it hit a VHS in like 1988. But E.T. dominated that summer. It was going to be the summer of Porky's, but then E.T. showed up. And of course, I showed up.
I mean, E.T. had drunken adventures just like the characters in Porky's. So mm-hmm. there's similarities. Yeah, no, E.T. is so big, it is impossible to, it's like trying to say, like, oh, you think you know how big the Beatles was because you compare it to like a thing that's big now. It's like, nah, things, this was bigger than that. Like, oh, you think like the Avengers movies are big, like E.T. was way bigger than that.
I think we covered something on that E.T. podcast where Steven Spielberg and George Lucas would send each other letters when E.T. beat Star Wars or vice versa through various re-releases. Like, oh, now E.T. is the highest. Oh, now Star Wars is the highest. Oh, look, E.T. lapped it again. Just back and forth throughout the early to mid-80s.
Yeah, no, they'd hire, I definitely know that they would hire artists to draw the characters, like, congratulating each other, of like E.T. Being congratulated by R2-D2 or Yoda or whatever, mm-hmm. and they'd put it in the trades. Like, that's, these are official, though non-canonical drawings of, like, Yoda and E.T. hanging out. Not to be confused with E.T.'s being part of the Galactic Senate in the prequels.
I hate to tell everybody this, but unfortunately, E.T. voted for Jar Jar Binks.
Look, he was going to break through and work with the evil emperor to make these things happen. It would have been worse if Jar Jar Binks didn't work with the emperor, Bob.
He was wearing the hat that said, make Star Wars no doo-doo again. I was trying to think of a Gungan catchphrase, but I really couldn't.
No, that's good. Like,
you say in a bigger doo-doo.
Trying to do that. I'm stealing a Mike Mitchell bit. He's done that before. I realized that as I was doing it. Like, I'm just doing what Mike
you
Mitchell
mean Boss
does.
Noss?
Yes, he Mike Mitchell does a much better imitation of Boss Nass. Yes.
So, yeah, absolutely destroyed at the box office by E.T. You're not going to take your kids to see some rat movie. You're going to see that little brown alien that stumbles around drunk in a flannel shirt. That's where I am. If I was of movie-seeing age in 82, I would be screaming at my parents, take me to E.T. Unfortunately, I was just born.
Yes, yeah, I didn't get to see it. I would have picked it over Secret of Nim as well. I mean, when I eventually saw them, I liked E.T. more than Secret of Nim too, but the Secret of Nim scared me. Like, when I saw it at 6 or 7 at like a school VHS cart playing, it terrified me. Mrs. Brisby being trapped in that cage, cutting her hand, like her arm, shit scared me a lot.
Dark stuff. So with the failure of Nim, Don Bluth Productions declared bankruptcy, but not all was lost, because Jerry Goldsmith, who wrote the score for Nim, told Bluth associate Gary Goldman that he recently screened the film for a friend, and this friend was bowled over. In fact, this friend wanted to meet the people who made The Secret of Nim. And of course, it was soon revealed that this friend was Steven Spielberg, which rightfully made everyone at the studio lose their damn minds, because he was essentially the Pope of Hollywood after E.T. broke every box office record at the time. So everyone put on their Sunday best for the Spielberg meeting. And of course, when he arrives, he's wearing baggy pants, a Hawaiian shirt, his trademark beat-up baseball cap, the classic Spielberg drip.
He looks exactly like you imagine Steven Spielberg in at least back then. Now, man, has he replaced it with like, I now guess it's more of a button up than the Hawaiian shirt these days, huh? But I still expect, if I meet Steven Spielberg and he doesn't have on a baseball hat, I am going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I don't know if he's ever gone hatless or if I've ever seen him hatless before in my life. I'm sure I have. At the Oscars, I guess, they make him take off his hat.
Well, last year I did the E.T. ride for the first time in a while, and it had like a 1999 ish video of Spielberg, and he's not wearing his hat then, and it's just him going like, guys, we got to get straight to it. What's that, E.T.? And then he just he talks with E.T. and says, like, you guys, here's the plot of the ride.
So Spielberg loved Nim, and he saw it as the revival of a golden age of animation, and immediately asked Don Bluth, well, how much did this cost to make? And when he finds out the budget was only $9 million, his eyes lit up, and he says, well, I've always wanted to make an animated movie. And then he's looking over the production materials. He's so excited to see these cells. And he asks the Bluth boys, so would you want to make an animated movie with me? And they're losing their minds. They manage to croak out yes. So he says, okay, great. I'll find the perfect story, and then I'll get back to you. So he leaves in his limo. They've just been blessed by the Pope of Hollywood. And there is a Spielberg movie that will be happening at Don Bluth Studios at some point, but they don't know when. And unfortunately, that perfect story would take Spielberg nearly 2 years to find. So in the meantime, Don Bluth Productions has to pay the bills by doing other stuff. And this is where they work in the world of video games. So things like Dragon's Lair, Dragon's Lair 2, and Space Ace, these are barely a game arcade games, but they still wowed arcade goers with the feature quality animation you were not seeing in the primitive games at the time.
And it's and by game, we really mean like a laser disc you hit back and forth on, right?
Yeah, it's just a glorified DVD menu with like all of the artifice hidden from you. Like, yeah, I guess you really had to be there for these as well. I've never enjoyed a full motion video game like this, where it's just essentially like based on visual cues, knowing like, okay, now hit this control direction, hit that control direction, hit the attack button. It was a funky age, and this kind of game did not last very long.
I loved walking by them and looking at them in wonder as a little kid in the arcade, and I feel like once or twice I put the quarters in it, lost immediately because I had no clue what I was doing, and then swore to never give a Dragon's Lair game my money again, I think.
Yeah, if you've never played this kind of a game before, you basically had to watch the attract mode to understand like how, okay, when the screen flashes, you need to put in a prompt. You're not actually moving the little man around on the screen. You're just kind of putting in prompts at certain intervals to let the game know, okay, I think I have to go up, or I think I have to go left or right, or I think I have to attack. It's very confusing, but briefly a big hit in arcades just through pure visual splendor. So this was not sustainable for Don Bluth Productions because the arcade boom ended, and arguably arcades would not really return until Street Fighter II in the early 90s, so they could not continue working on these full-motion video games. They declare bankruptcy again, and jeez. Don Bluth Productions reforms as the Bluth Group. So it started as Don Bluth Productions, and then it became the Bluth Group, and then they file bankruptcy again, so now they have to reform as something else, and we'll talk about that later. So there are two bankruptcies between The Secret of Nim and An American Tale for Don Bluth.
Man, that is rough for him. But also, I guess that shows you how bad animation was. This is before the Renaissance that'll come later. Like, Disney feature is doing pretty shitty. The only things that are getting put into theaters, like in the mid to early 80s, are like total garbage, like the He-Man movie, which is not like that. That basically has the budget of 3 episodes of the TV show, maybe 6 episodes of the TV show.
Yeah, they're cheap. They're packages of things you might have seen on television. It's a bad time for theatrical animation. So yes, bankruptcy happens again. And back with Nim, a lot of the producers, and I believe Bluth too, had to mortgage their houses to raise money to finish the movie. So at every stage, things are extremely harrowing for Bluth, and it feels like he's being punished for leaving what seemed like a cushy job at Disney. Although, again, there was no idea if Disney would continue making feature animation, so you can understand why he left.
It didn't seem like he had as much of a positive income coming in compared to, say, Richard Williams, who at least his studio, despite his inability to finish any real projects, Richard Williams was getting a lot more work on commercials in the UK and the rest of Europe, as opposed to like Bluth. Either he wasn't getting hired for the commercials, or maybe didn't want to work on commercials. I don't know. But like, seemed like Richard Williams, for all of his faults as a person producing animation, he could at least keep the money coming in with the commercials.
So there's a bit of a side quest I want to take us on. It'll take a minute, but it's mentioned in his biography. So things are looking their darkest for Don Bluth. He's declared bankruptcy again for the second time, like I said earlier. And then he gets a call from another entertainment superstar of the 80s. It's none other than Wacko Jacko himself, Michael Jackson. And now he wants to have a meeting with Don Bluth. So they have this very secret meeting. He mentions that before he goes in to talk to Michael, the guy at the door says, you know, nobody gets to talk to Michael. You're very lucky to talk to Michael. And they have their meeting. Jackson finds out that Don Bluth is going to be working with Spielberg. He lights up because Michael Jackson is working on an adaptation of Peter Pan with Spielberg. It's a musical and he's going to be Peter Pan. That might have been better than Hook, but it was never made.
though it's remembered worse. It would be remembered worse maybe now.
Yes.
But
it might not be so easy to stream as Hook if Michael Jackson starred in the Peter Pan movie where he hangs out on an island with boys.
How hard is it to find his, you know, the film for Moonwalker now? How available is that, I wonder?
I don't know. I remember it being a weirdly muted release even at the time. And I rented it on video as a kid, but I never remember it actually being in theaters.
Though that's funny, the, you know, again, the him working with Michael Jackson, Spielberg. There's a line in Goonies where Chunk is, you know, lying that Michael Jackson came to visit and nobody believes. And he's like, no, it was his sister. That's based on, no, Michael Jackson and his sister did visit the set of Goonies during production of Goonies. So that's an in-joke when Chunk says it. So, which, again, now that that fun story is not so fun to think about, I'd say, or less fun.
Yeah, this is Michael Jackson kind of near the height of his power. I think Bad, the Bad era is where, I mean, I guess we're at Thriller, so it's between maybe Thriller to Bad. We're at peak Michael, but
yeah,
he's given access to all of these people. Whoever he wants to meet, he'll meet and propose a weird project to them. So a little side quest I wanted to mention. There could have been a Michael Jackson-Don Bluth collaboration. I'm glad that didn't happen. But then in 1984, the call from Spielberg finally comes in. And he pitches the broad strokes of An American Tale and also gives the movie its name. So he proposes this movie. It's called An American Tale, T-A-I-L, very cute. Originally, Fievel was named Mousy Moutskowitz. But eventually Spielberg said, okay, this name is uninspired. Why don't you change it to my Russian grandfather's name? His name was actually Philip Posner, but his Yiddish name was Fievel. And Fievel would have been about as old as his grandfather, given when this movie takes place. So it's a movie where the star is basically Steven Spielberg's grandfather in mouse form. I have not seen The Fabelmans yet. I don't know if his grandfather was actually a mouse with a big hat.
I'm trying to remember. In The Fabelmans, the oldest member of his family you meet is like an old uncle played by Judd Hirsch, who's really great. His scenes are like Oscar. He got nominated for it, and rightly, deservedly so, Oscar nominated. But by the setting of The Fabelmans, I think his grandfather might have been dead at that point. But yeah, Fievel is an inventive name to use. It certainly makes him stand out from all of the many, many other cartoon mice out there.
Yeah, this movie released in the same year as The Great Mouse Detective, of course. That's a movie that we covered, 5 or 6 years ago. So lots of mice. Don Bluth was like, another mouse movie? Okay, I guess Steven Spielberg is pitching this to me. I made The Rescuers. I made Secret of Nim. Now I'm doing more mice. And I remember, like, I think we covered Great Mouse Detective. There was a fear that there were too many mouse projects happening.
I mean, it did. I do think this probably hurt The Great Mouse Detective's performance by having such a similar mouse movie. And I also wonder, too, like, Spielberg definitely said this. I guess it would be after the 86 release of this. But when they were working on Roger Rabbit, he was clear of saying, like, oh, yeah, we need to hire Richard Williams because Disney feature animation ain't what it used to be. Like, and that pissed off Disney feature animation hearing that. So I would guess that same sentiment is coming through here of him wanting to take this to work with Bluth and his team instead of pitching it to Disney as a Disney feature.
But apparently Bluth pushed back a little on the Fievel thing. He thought it was too foreign and kids wouldn't remember how to say it or know how to say it. But I mean, honestly, I feel like there's no other character named Fievel, so you've already cornered the market on Fievel. I'm glad it wasn't Mousy, but there was a compromise in that some characters would refer to him by his Americanized name of Philly, which honestly I think is very stupid because a Philly is a horse, and when they're yelling out Philly, it sounds idiotic to me. I don't like it.
I mean, it sounds like the thing that a New Yorker rat, hey, I'm walking here type guy would name him. I could see that.
And Spielberg's vision was more of a purely animal world. Bluth didn't think that worked for Robin Hood or The Fox and the Hound, so take that, furries. He suggested that American Tale also feature humans, and then Spielberg's like, all right, I trust you, Don Bluth. You've proven you know what you can do via Secret of Nim and your work at Disney. I will greenlight this. It'll go into production. I'm going to go to Japan to film Empire of the Sun. And while I'm doing that, I'll send in notes. I'm sure there are faxes going back and forth, but Spielberg is overseeing the entire process. And like with a lot of these guys, he has a lot to learn that, like, you know, a simple suggestion can add weeks and weeks of work to an animated project. This is a real learning experience for him. And it put a lot of pressure on the people back in the United States working on the film that it's hard to say no to Steven Spielberg, regardless of what he's asking.
It is, again, crazy that, like, he's mainly filming Empire of the Sun in Shanghai, and which was a big deal then, like, that's, again, how big Spielberg was as the filmmaker. Even in, you know, China, they were like, oh, we'll let you film in Shanghai. You're the first American production that's gotten to film there, I'm pretty sure, since the 60s, at the very least. It was seen as a huge deal then, but I would guess that makes it probably even harder for him to send messages to working on this. Though, again, that's crazy, because, like, those two movies got compared so much, Empire of the Sun. They're both about, like, Christian Bale basically goes through a Five-alike adventure in the... They attempt to sell him into child labor, just like happens to Five-al as well.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I have to imagine that it's much better than American Tail, because, spoilers, folks, I don't think this is a good movie, but it's going to be fun to talk about.
It is better. It is better, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I guess I think it would have to be, but let's continue. So Spielberg working remotely on this film, giving notes, as I assume he did with a lot of these animated things he was involved with, just being very busy, being Steven Spielberg, but still being available to look at storyboards, look at scripts, and let people know, like, oh, here are some choices I would make. Can you make these? And in terms of production, Bluth set out to make this movie have a very different visual style from The Rescuers and The Secret of Nim. And he decided to ape the style of Disney's features from the 40s in order to make this new creation look soft and cuddly and warm and marketable. And, I mean, he left Disney because he thought they were straying too far from that style. So this is an attempt to bring it back. Like, everything is just so warm and cuddly and rosy. And, like, even like, the screen is, like, Vaseline'd a bit during certain scenes.
It's interesting to hear that choice to not make it the just a full animal world. Though that, again, makes it more similar to The Great Mouse Detector, that choice. Because both of them are about, like, a, like, shadow world of mice living the reflected lives of humans at the same time. Like, in both cases, in The Great Mouse Detective, is like, here's Sherlock Holmes' house. Did you know right below him is a Sherlock Holmes type mouse? And here it's like, here's immigrants coming in, and here's the immigrant mice coming in.
Yeah, like, I think both movies start with the same shot where it's a house, and then you pan down to the smaller mouse house next to the house, and the people and the mice have very similar names.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, you're right. Extremely, very, very similar ideas there going in. I wonder how much the two teams were aware of one another when they were working on this. I can't recall if that came up in Great Mouse Detective. That was many podcasts ago as well.
So we're in the early 80s when we're making this movie, mid 80s, approaching that point. And this is a very toyetic era. This is when the restrictions are lifted on that you can now advertise to children and it's fine and no one has any problem with it. So they're really interested in merchandising. One group has a big amount of input on the making of this movie and the character design, and that is the marketing department of Sears. Now, folks, Sears used to be a big department store that would sell your mom a blouse, and maybe they'd sell you Super Metroid, and they'd also sell your dad a lawnmower. And the point is, they would sell everything to everybody, but they also had the annual toy catalog that many a kid from the 80s and 90s, and presumably earlier, would page through every Christmas and circle the toys they wanted and maybe get some of them. Well, they had a huge amount of input on how Five-al looked, because a lot of this was about, we need to sell this little bastard to all the other little bastards out there.
Yeah, that man, that Sears got to have such an input on it is so funny. But it was the Amazon of its day, I suppose.
It really was. Although you had to walk there, and I assume the employees were treated better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The last time I visited a Sears in my hometown mall, large sections of it were walled off because there was no products to sell.
But yes, you're right. Walking into the World of Nintendo section of Sears was, again, of like childhood dream.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Sears really wants to sell Five-als to all. And let's talk about the people who created Five-als. So there is a created by credit, which is weird because this is a Steven Spielberg produced movie directed by Don Bluth. But the creator is somebody completely different. And this person is David Kirschner, who expands Spielberg's sketch of a story. So Kirschner is given the created by credit. So I'm going to assume he was first at bat for the screenplay. And he is a very interesting guy. Let me tell you about his history. So he starts his career by creating illustrations for album covers. And then he moves on to illustrating characters for Muppets and Sesame Street books and merchandise. So he is working in the world of merchandisable art, in other words. But Spielberg likely hired him thanks to Rose Petal Place, which was a book series that launched a few animated specials, but was mostly created to sell a line of strawberry shortcake-like merchandise. And strawberry shortcake was basically, to be reductive, He-Man for girls. Just like how boys had He-Man and Thundercats, girls had their own lines of dolls with tons of accessories, tons of characters, and you needed to buy all of them. In Reagan's America.
Yeah, it was definitely the girls I knew had, if they didn't have all the their favorite characters from Strawberry Shortcake, it would be Rainbow Bright. Those were one of those two.
Yeah. My consciousness emerged into a world where my sister had like all the Rainbow Bright and Strawberry Shortcake stuff, so I immediately did not like it. I thought, like, who is this? None of this is being explained to me. These cartoons aren't on TV anymore. I need to know.
Well, and you're not supposed to, even if you like smelling the sweet strawberry smell of a strawberry shortcake, you're not supposed to like it if you're a boy either.
So yeah, they're hiring this guy because he has experience creating media that will then spawn toys. So it is funny. There is a lot of cynicism behind the creation of An American Tale. Yes, it is Spielberg wanting to tell the immigrant story of his Jewish grandfather, but also money and selling little fivels and storybooks and holiday stockings. So they're really in tune with what the 80s were all about. And it's very funny how you think Don Bluth is leaving Disney to create serious art or to make his own stamp on the industry. No, he wants to make cuddly crap that you want to buy. He is purely like a businessman in terms of making animated features.
I mean, it sounds more methodically merchandise than Disney's movie that was that year. Like, and that they're working directly with these companies. And yeah, that created by credit is so strange. Like, that feels very contractual to me of like, if you want me to work on this, then I get creator credit, which even if it is like adapting something that is, you know, outside of the system and it's adapting a book, even then, a created by credit like that is not what you see at the start of an animated feature film. Even one that's based on, like, the Black Cauldron didn't say created by the person who wrote the Black Cauldron.
Yeah, it will say based on the original book by blank. A created by credit for a movie is bizarre. So I'm wondering what's going on there. Could not find any answers, but more about David Kirschner. So weirdly enough, after this, he'd go on to be a producer of the Child's Play series of movies, and he is credited with even creating the Chucky animatronic puppet. And then he works on all the other Child's Play stuff, and he was even an executive producer on the recent Child's Play series that people really seem to love. Or I guess it was just called Chucky?
Oh, yeah, the Chucky things, I guess. I've heard a lot of LGBTQ folks love it from a queer perspective, also because the lead director of the series is a gay man as well. So that's interesting. But, that's also funny because basically they just took the My Buddy toy and made it like, what if that was evil? And so, yeah.
It was looking at another very merchandise 80s character and said, what if it had a knife?
Which that is pretty scary. Can't lie.
So other credits worth mentioning. So, of course, he worked on the American Tale sequel. And then he's credited with the story for the movie Hocus Pocus. He also wrote The Pagemaster. And his credits are a very wild mix of TV animation, feature animation, and Chucky stuff. Although a large part of his life was taken up by working on the Curious George TV program that ran for 16 years. There's a lot of it.
Wow.
The animated show.
Man, that's crazy. Is that the one in the aughts or a different era?
This is, it began in 2006, ended in like 2022.
This was when Ron Howard's company was working on it then, I think. It was a big get for them through the Imagination Films, got to work on it. I think it's part of that. They did the movie that Will Ferrell was the voice of the yellow man in the yellow hat, I remember.
Okay. I assume the movie was meant to relaunch the character for a new audience.
Yeah. Did kids today know Curious George? He was, it was a reboot when we saw him in the 80s. Like, it was like your mom's favorite book when we saw him.
We need to move on with Curious George. So yes, very eclectic career. Now the creator of Fievel's, so every Fievel project, which there has not been one since 1999, he is credited with, created by David Kirschner. And we have the screenplay writers next. We have Judy Freudberg and Tony Geiss. So let's learn a little more about them. So the previous year, Freudberg and Geis wrote the screenplay for the Sesame Street movie Follow That Bird. Talk about nightmare fuel. This is another movie where I would see snippets of it on TV, not really knowing what it was, but it's so dark and so weird. And when they're off the set of Sesame Street, it makes me uncomfortable.
I guess in both cases, they're about a sad, lonely character left behind by other cute animals, right? Mm-hmm. That are in search of that the lost character.
And they cage that bird?
Oh, man, just like how Fievel gets put in a cage by Tiger.
For about 10 seconds, right?
Yeah. Long enough to set up a song.
Yeah, that doesn't really pay off in any way. We'll talk about it.